Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today we will return to the archives and continue reading the February 2020 issue of Guideposts with articles like the cover story, A Spirit of Power. A Spirit of Power. As a journalist, Tamron Hall knows sometimes the hardest story is the one you have to tell. By Tamron Hall, New York, New York. You'd think as the host of a daytime talk show, encouraging people to tell their stories, that I would have no hesitation about telling my own. True, there's a lot I'm willing to talk about, but one of the biggest, saddest, toughest, and most important stories I didn't share for years. I opened up only when I saw that others needed to understand, that they needed to know what I wish I had known back then, that lives could be saved, that my heart need not have been broken. Renate was technically my stepsister, but that's not how I would have ever described her. She was my sister, plain and simple. I was 8 when my mom remarried. Dad, as I learned to call him, and his daughter came into my life. She was 14 years older than me and the coolest person I'd ever seen. Exuberant and generous and so glamorous. I loved going with her to Eckhart Drugs in our hometown of Lulling, Texas, and seeing her work her magic with drugstore beauty products she bought. She'd come out of the bathroom ready to go out, looking amazing. When it came time for my senior prom, Renate was my stylist, of course. I cringe now at the pictures of me in my big hair and my fuchsia dress with long white gloves. This was the late 80s, mind you, but I was voted best dress thanks to Renate. Later, after I graduated from Temple University with a degree in broadcast journalism and was making my way in the business, Renate would visit and give me pointers on what to wear. Once it was a pair of yellow suede pants. No way, I said, looking at myself in the mirror. Trust me, you look great, Renate said. As usual, she was right. Although her taste was impeccable in so many ways, in one area it was flawed, and I couldn't understand why. Not for years. Even as a kid, I remember overhearing Mom and Dad whispering, "That guy is no good for Renate," or telling her directly, "Why do you want to be with him?" Late one night when I was in my teens, she came home from a date, her face bruised. She told Dad that the guy she was with tried to attack her and she jumped out of a moving car. How was it possible that someone so beautiful and confident on the outside could be so insecure, seeking validation? Didn't she know that God loved her and she deserved to be loved by others? Church and prayer were a natural part of our lives. Dad and Renate went to the AME church while Mom and I worshiped at Beth Eden Baptist. Then we'd all gather at home for Sunday dinner. We prayed without fail before every meal. At that Thanksgiving, when Renate and I would fight over who got the turkey wings, we thanked God for every good thing in our lives, and for me, that always included my big sister. Why would she look for love in the wrong places? One time, Renate came to visit me in Chicago, when I was anchoring a morning news show. She brought along the person in her life, someone our family knew, and they stayed with me at my townhouse. That first night we hung out, went dancing, and had a great time. The second night, they came to the TV station and she helped choose my outfit for the next morning. They seemed comfortable with each other, relaxed. But later that night, I was upstairs and heard a commotion downstairs, a crashing sound, a thud. I rushed down to see what was wrong. My glass top table was knocked over. Renate stood there looking disoriented, the area above her right eye starting to swell. I glared at the man. "I didn't do anything," he said. "I didn't do anything. Get out," I said to him. "She hit me," he said, insisting it wasn't his fault. "Get out," I said again, and grabbed the phone to call Dad. Dad said, "Get him out of your house right away." I picked up a broom and waved it threateningly until he finally left. Then I grabbed an ice pack from the freezer to give to Renate. "You're too good for him," I said, sounding just like our parents did. "You're beautiful and smart and wonderful. You can do so much better. You don't need a guy like him." I put Renate to bed and told her to get some rest. Not until years later did I learn how hard it can be to talk someone out of an abusive relationship. You can't just snap them out of it with words of affirmation. Mom and Dad and I had tried that many times. Victims of domestic abuse get caught in a cyclical bond of trauma, desperately thinking they can change things or that they're not strong enough to leave. I wish I'd said something much more direct, something Renate could have responded to, something like, "You're in danger with this man. How can I help?" I was so upset and afraid for both of us and frustrated that the next morning I told her that she had to leave too. I couldn't have her and that man in my house again, no matter what he said. She would come back by herself, but never with him. Renate packed up and left, and we didn't speak for months. Finally, at Dad's urging, we reconciled. I'm grateful for that. Without it, the burden of guilt over what happened next would have been unbearable. Still, I asked myself, could I have handled things differently? Could I have made it possible for her to reach out and talk? Could I have saved my sister? The call came a couple of months later in 2004. Renate had been found floating face down in her backyard pool. She had been bludgeoned. The police said that there had been signs of struggle, hair pulled out, her fingernails broken. Renate had called Mom the night before and told her that she was ending the relationship. Now my sister was dead. The police told us to sit tight and not make waves while we waited for them to collect more evidence and arrest the person of interest. Meanwhile, that man came to the funeral and sat in front of me, the man I knew killed my sister. In the end, he was never charged due to a lack of evidence. Because of that, I can't even legally say his name. Dad's health went into a precipitous decline. Mom said that he died of a broken heart. He believed that it was his job to protect his girls. With Renate, he felt he'd failed. As for me, I didn't speak publicly about my sister's death for years. It was too painful, too devastating to talk about. I turned to the Psalms for solace, and my mom and my aunt texted me Bible verses every day. It was only as I learned more about domestic violence that I started to use my position in the media to help others, to reach out to people like Renate and help them free themselves of an abusive relationship. It can be done. Mustering all my courage, I finally spoke out about our family tragedy at a press conference in 2014. I expected a slew of questions. Instead, a reporter shot me down, moving on some other topic. I was shocked. Didn't he understand how many people needed help? The numbers are staggering. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men have experienced some form of domestic violence, and nearly half of all female murder victims are killed by an intimate partner. Survivors of intimate partner violence lose nearly 8 million days of paid work each year. Didn't that reporter see how shrouding the issue in secrecy only made it worse? After that, I decided I needed to be braver, to be fiercely honest. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love, says the Bible. I would tap into that power. Today, I use my voice whenever I can to help victims of domestic violence. If you know someone who's trapped in an abusive relationship, listen to them. Don't judge. Don't jump right in right away with advice. Let them talk. Get them somewhere safe. Many churches offer counseling and a place to stay. Offer to do the legwork, making phone calls, scheduling appointments. To be connected to a resource in your area, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. I established the Tamron Renate Fund to aid Safe Horizon, a national organization that offers a variety of programs to support survivors of abuse. I lost my sister, Renate. I don't want other families to suffer the same. Every morning I pray before I even leave the house. I check on my infant son, Moses, who is usually still sleeping, kiss my husband, and get ready to go to ABC Studios, asking God to give me the right words, words that have meaning and understanding, as I interview people and hear their stories. I say that prayer when I tell my own story, urging others to talk about what they're going through. Words matter, and the right words can save a life. For more on this story, see Family Room. Animals and Healing, The Power of a Pup by Carol Kuykendall, Boulder, Colorado. For the first time in 52 years of marriage, we truly had an empty nest. No kids, no dog, and no patience with each other. "I'm back," my husband Lynn announced, shuffling into the kitchen that afternoon last September with his arm full of groceries. "Sooner than I expected," I said, without looking up from my computer screen. I'd finally hit my stride, paying some bills and catching up on email, and here he was back home already. "No heroes welcome?" he asked, unloading the groceries on the counter right next to where I was working. Sorry, just trying to get some things done. I won't interrupt, he promised, putting away the cans and boxes in the kitchen cabinets. Then, as always, he left the doors wide open. Could you please close the cupboard doors? I could hear the edge in my voice. Sure, Lynn said, not looking at me as he banged the doors shut. Then he began loading the refrigerator at a glacial pace, making me crazy that he was leaving the fridge door open for so long, letting all the cold air out. What was it with him and doors? I forced myself to hold my tongue and flip my laptop closed. I'll go in the other room to finish up what I'm doing. Sure, he said, again, his back still turned to me. I headed down the hall to our bedroom and some solitude. Sitting down, I gazed out the window and wondered why I was getting so nitpicky and worked up over such minor things these days. I appreciated that Lynn did some of the grocery shopping now that he was retired, but I got annoyed by things like his goofy wool hat that made him look like a smurf, or the way he sometimes shuffled his feet. No wonder he didn't seem to enjoy my company just now either. Of course, marriage has its ups and downs, but after 52 years, it seemed as if we'd fallen into a cycle of mutual annoyance without even knowing how we'd gotten there. When did we stop looking at each other when we talked? When did we start watching television at dinner time? This wasn't the way I wanted to love Lynn or live out our lives. Something had to change. Later, when I was cutting up vegetables to make soup for dinner, our daughter Lindsay stopped by on her way to pick up the kids from school. Hi, Mom, she said, leaning over the counter to grab a carrot. Where's Dad? Downstairs in his office. He's always downstairs, and this house is too quiet these days, she said, then grinned as if she had the most wonderful idea in the world. You and Dad should get another puppy. You know we can't do that again. We're beyond that season, especially the puppy season. Of course you can, she said. You two have always been dog people, and dog people should have a dog. And there's nothing like a puppy to shake things up and get you out of your own heads. After Lindsay left, I wondered how she could possibly know anything about our season of life. But she did know us, and so I thought about her suggestion. For the first time in our married life, Lynn and I were truly living an empty nest. We always had a dog. A golden retriever puppy was our first baby. Then came three children and two more golden retrievers. 10 years ago, after we'd both been diagnosed with advanced cancers, we bought Chemo, our last beloved golden, as a reward for finishing chemotherapy. We survived, but Chemo died of cancer last year. Our last dog, we vowed to each other. We couldn't go through that kind of grief ever again. Besides, at this stage, all our friends had stopped getting new dogs. Still, I had to admit that our lives without a dog were certainly less active, less interesting, less fun. That night at dinner, I said, "What would you think about us getting another puppy?" Lynn stared at me, his spoon suspended between bowl and mouth. "I thought you were totally against getting another dog, especially a puppy." Lindsay thinks a puppy would be good for us. It would definitely be a challenge, but we've always been good at loving something together. Lynn took his time answering. Finally, he said, "Have you forgotten how puppies wreak havoc in the house? They chew up everything in sight." I know. They're trouble, but they're worth it." "What about all the training?" Lynn asked. "We'd have to share that responsibility, but I'd take a dog to puppy classes," I said, my enthusiasm growing. "That would be fun for me." We carried our puppy talk over the next several days. "I'm still not sure," Lynn said several times, but I'd learned that when faced with a tough decision, he asked lots of questions and voiced doubts in order to reach the right conclusion. It was clear he wanted me to convince him, even as I was convincing myself. I researched local breeders, made a couple phone calls, and texted several dog people friends to see if they had any suggestions. One friend got back to me immediately. "Whatever you do, don't get a puppy," she texted, adding the hashtag, "People our age don't do puppies." I felt a determination to prove her wrong. The very next day, I got a call about an available 12-week-old golden retriever whose initial arrangement to become a service dog had fallen through. While we weren't ready to commit yet, I knew this golden opportunity wouldn't last long. To my surprise, Lynn agreed to have the trainer bring over the puppy that afternoon. As soon as we saw the little guy bounding out of the trainer's arms, tripping all over himself to meet us, we were totally smitten. I picked him up and breathed in that unmistakable puppy smell, then handed him to Lynn. "You want to come live at our house?" he asked, nose to nose with the puppy. And that was that. We had an adorable new member of the family. The first task we tackled together was buying a puppy crate, a new bed, and food the trainer recommended. Now we need a name, I told Lib. We pondered this important responsibility as we looked at the sleeping puppy. Needs to be a strong male name, Lynn said, but not like Bruno or Bubba. We always picked names with a special meaning for us, like Chemo and Rhodey from Rhode Island, I added. What about Ezekiel after the prophet, Lynn said. We learned about him last week in Bible study. Ezekiel brought hope and encouragement to his people, and we could use some of both. Tried out the name. Ezekiel. No, Zeke. I like it. Lynn smiled. Zeke it is. Before we knew it, squeaky toys and chew bones once again littered our floors. A puppy playpen filled one corner of the kitchen. In the bedroom, we wedged Zeke's large crate in next to our bed. We fell into familiar routines just as we had with all our other dogs. When I let Zeke out of his crate in the morning, he shared his good morning joy by jumping up on the bed to snuggle with us. Next up were twice daily walks, regardless of the weather, and trips with us to the stores that welcome dogs. When we first took Zeke outside, he'd run around and around in circles until he tired himself out and had to lie down on the grass, panting. Best of all was when we'd tell him sternly, no barking, he immediately switched to a sound somewhere between a low growl and a hum. We call it Zeke speak. Of course, there were many days when our new housemate was nothing but trouble. I spent countless hours scrubbing and spraying the off-white carpet in the living room in a mostly vain effort to erase Zeke's little accidents. His favorite search and destroy missions were to our bedroom, hoping to catch the closet door open so he could practice his shoe chewing. One afternoon, after we'd had him for several weeks, I found him innocently gnawing the sole of one of my favorite sandals. The closet door was wide open, just like those kitchen cabinets. I yelled for Lynn. You have to remember to close the closet door, I told him sharply, holding up the ruined shoe. Why do I have to keep telling you? Lynn looked surprised and irritated at my tone. It had been a while since we'd been snippy like that with each other. But then Zeke looked up at us with those big brown eyes and tilted his head as if to say, Hey, I'm just a puppy. What do you expect? Lynn and I laughed and the tension melted away. You think it's time to sign him up for those training classes? Lynn asked. I'll see when the next class starts, I said, but I do remember the most important thing the trainer always taught us, that real bonding comes from direct eye contact with a puppy. She advised us to practice with people. Let's try it. I locked eyes with Lynn. At first, it felt awkward because we hadn't had that kind of eye-to-eye contact for a long time. Do you love our puppy? I asked, holding my husband's gaze. I do, he said, smiling. He makes our house happier. Us happier, too. I felt proud that we'd met the puppy challenge at this stage in our lives. But he still needs some serious training, Lynn said, or we're both going to need a lot of new shoes. We'll manage, I told him, just as we always have. By figuring things out together. For more on this story, see Family Room. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, you may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine each week, we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. New beginnings. Love wins. What if your daughter told you something about herself that went against everything you were taught to believe? By Christy Johnson, Edmond, Oklahoma. My 20-year-old daughter, Brittany, had left the computer on in my bedroom. She'd been using it to chat with friends. The chat session was still on the screen. Maybe I shouldn't have read it, but I'm a mom and I couldn't help myself. We'll meet you at the rec room, Brittany had written at the end. My husband, John, Brittany's stepfather, walked in. Have you ever heard of a place called the rec room? I asked him. No, he said with a shrug. Why? Brittany's going there tonight. I looked up the rec room online. What? It was an all-ages gay nightclub on 39th Street, the heart of Oklahoma City's gay neighborhood. That couldn't be right. Why would Brittany want to go there? I'd grown up in a very conservative church environment and raised Brittany the same way. When I came from where I came from, the Bible was crystal clear about homosexuality. Someone who lived that way was out of God's favor. Brittany was living at home while working and attending community college. In some ways, she was a grown-up. In others, she was still pretty naive. Maybe she just didn't know what the rec room was. And yet, why was my whole body rigid with fear? I racked my brain for reassurance that Brittany wasn't gay. There was that guy she pined over in high school who was dating someone else. Later, he broke up with that other girl, and he and Brittany went to prom, but nothing came of it. Other than that, she had never dated, never had a boyfriend. Not that John and I gave her much wiggle room. We taught a singles class at church based on purity movement. The idea was to avoid casual dating and focus on marriage. We steered Brittany towards group outings with friends, and she never rebelled against that. The only time she and I had a big disagreement was over the subject when she expressed curiosity about one of her eighth grade teachers who was a lesbian. "That's kind of cool," Brittany said when she found out. "It's not cool," I replied, and followed up with a lecture about what I believe the Bible said about sexuality. Brittany stopped talking about her teacher. I called John over to the computer. We stood there staring at the screen, both feeling deeply uncomfortable. John's daughter from his first marriage, Melissa, had apparently been questioning her own sexuality as well. Brittany and Melissa were only a year apart. Were they influencing each other? Melissa had moved out as soon as she turned 18. She and I had a difficult relationship. Earlier that day, she'd driven over from her mom's house where she was living to hang out with Brittany. They were now out getting something to eat. It was clear from the chat session that they were planning to go to the rec room tonight. They are not going to that place, I said to John. No way, he said, though we both knew we didn't have a lot of leverage with Melissa. We confronted the girls when they came back. "Do you even know what the rec room is?" I asked Brittany. "You read my chat session? You left my computer on. You are not going to a gay bar. Homosexuality is wrong. You know that." An expression I'd never seen before came over my daughter's face. Defiance and something else. She looked wounded. "How do you know what's wrong?" she said. "My friends go there and I like it. I don't see anything wrong with it and I'll go back as soon as I get a chance." She stormed out. For 2 weeks we fought. I quoted scripture, gave lectures. Brittany never outright said she was gay, but I knew she was fascinated by that whole subject. Dismayed and bewildered, I issued an ultimatum. "You know what I believe. If you can't follow my rules, you have to move out." Brittany packed up her things and moved into her own apartment. The following months were a nightmare. Brittany had cut me off. She came over Thanksgiving, but I ruined it by using the opportunity to lecture her. Emotions warred inside me. Horror, fear, shame, regret. How could my own daughter do this to me? And yet I missed her so much. Brittany's childhood hadn't been easy. My first husband was a drug addict who was abusive and neglected our children. Once driving under the influence, he wrecked his car and killed Brittany's youngest brother. I had to get out of that marriage. The divorce and her dad's chaotic life took its toll on Brittany. She was never rebellious, just quiet and contained, bottling up her emotions. There was a lot about her life I didn't know. I thought I'd done everything right, read scripture to Brittany and her brother Garrett, monitored what they watched, who their friends were. Where did I go wrong? Reading 1 Corinthians one day, I came to the part where Paul says that if someone is sexually immoral or greedy, an idolater or slanderer, a drunkard or a swindler, a believer should not even eat with such people. Brittany came over that day to do laundry. She sat uncomfortably at the kitchen table waiting for the wash to finish. A sudden impulse to open my heart came over me. I joined her at the table and told her about the Corinthians passage. "I don't know what that means," I said, starting to cry. "Am I not even supposed to eat with you?" Brittany did her best to remain stone-faced, but she began to cry too. We stared at each other helplessly. When the laundry was done, Brittany folded everything and drove away. Soon after, her life unraveled. She flunked out of college and got a DUI. To my utter confusion, she moved into a filthy house with relatives who used a lot of prescription pain medication. Brittany was sleeping on a dirty mattress on the floor. I went over one day to visit. Overwhelmed by depression, she didn't even get out of bed. I was overwhelmed, too, by emotion. I felt caught between my love for Brittany and my obedience to what I read in Scripture, what I'd been taught to believe. I didn't dare tell anyone at church. What would they say? Part of me was relieved that John was having his own struggle with Melissa. Both he and I had endured rocky first marriages. It would have been so easy for either of us to sit in judgment. One day I was out getting the mail when my friend Julie drove by. Julie is one of the most perceptive, straight-talking people I know. "What's wrong?" she asked. "Oh, it's Brittany," I said. Julie eyed me. She knew exactly what was going on. "You blame yourself, don't you?" she said. I nodded. "Let me ask you," she said, "if Brittany had turned out perfect in your eyes, would you have taken credit?" "Of course," I said. Julie shook her head. "Then you would have been full of pride. Whatever Brittany did, it's God's job to judge. Your job is to love your daughter." Julie drove away, and I stood there feeling stung. Then, to my amazement, a sense of liberation began to build inside me. If Julie was right, I could love my daughter as she was without having to answer all the hard theological questions. Right there by the mailbox, I prayed about it. As clear as day, God replied, "Why would Brittany ever want to be with someone as judgmental as you are?" Another passage from Corinthians came to mind. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. I went inside and called Brittany. "Want to get some coffee sometime?" "I would love that," she said. Slowly we worked to rebuild our relationship. We got coffee, went to garage sales. I called her just to talk and avoided the issue of sexuality. The more we talked, the easier it became. I knew it was a risk for Brittany to trust me. I didn't want to let her down. John and I decided to take the whole family, Brittany, Garrett, Melissa, on a 5-day Caribbean cruise. It sounded kind of crazy, but we realized that what we needed most of all was undistracted time together. We threw a bon voyage party, and Melissa invited her best friend, Robbie, and his boyfriend. I had met these young men before and frankly found them extremely nice and easy to talk to once I let go of my judgment. They arrived with a huge cake decorated like a cruise ship, a peace offering. I realized that they had to work just as hard to accept someone like me, a conservative Christian who disagreed with how they lived. We had a great time at the party and an even better time on the cruise. Something must have happened out there on the water. Soon after we returned, Brittany began pulling herself back together. She found work and entered into a long-term relationship. Her partner, Nicole, became like a third daughter in our family. I no longer hide what I tell people at church because I'm no longer ashamed of my daughter. I feel closer to God than ever when I remember that He extended infinite grace to me, enabling me to extend grace and love to Brittany. I don't have all the answers. What I do know is that the Bible tells me to trust, to hope, and to persevere in love. Those are words Brittany and I can embrace with all our hearts. That's all the time we have today for Guidepost. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.